This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
It's Friday, September 17th, 2021. Welcome to Now with Dave Brown. I'm Mike Ross, in for Dave. You're on AMI. Let's hit those horns. Let's go. Coming up on the show today, we have our weekly news panel with Michelle McQuigg and Juwita Gupta joining us. Today, we discuss the COVID-19 crisis in Alberta and consider the interference of politics on public health policies. We also chat about the ethics and optics of anti-vaccination protests at hospitals across Canada. And we ask ourselves how we're feeling about the 2021 federal election campaign. In the second hour of the show, entertainment critic Michael McNeely continues his coverage of this year's Toronto International Film Festival. And AMI's communication specialist Greg David gives us the scoop on the 73rd annual Primetime Emmy Awards. That and lots more coming up now with Dave Brown here on AMI. I'm Mike Ross, filling in for Dave, who returns on Monday from his vacation. Let's get to our top story this morning, which is the federal election campaign. And with just a few days to go before Election Day, the three main party leaders were continuing a tour of Eastern and Central Canada yesterday, but the focus yesterday was squarely on Western Canada and Alberta. At a campaign stop in Montreal, Liberal leader Justin Trudeau addressed the COVID-19 situation in Alberta, where Jason Kenney, the premier, had declared a state of public health emergency and reintroduced limits on gatherings.
The choices that leaders make in a crisis matter. Half measures won't do to fight this pandemic, to keep people safe, to prevent further lockdowns, to further slow the growth of our economy.
Trudeau also admonished Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole for recently applauding Jason Kenney's handling of the pandemic in Alberta.
Because just a few days ago, Mr. O'Toole was still applauding Mr. Kenney for his management of the pandemic. We know the way to get through this pandemic is through vaccinations. But Mr. O'Toole is still letting the anti-vaxxers within his own party run the show.
Now, Aaron O'Toole was asked about COVID-19 and asked about the spreading Delta variant and the situation in Alberta. And he blamed Justin Trudeau for launching an expensive, unnecessary election campaign.
Mr. Trudeau called an election that's costing us $600 million rather than keeping the Delta variant from spreading, rather than actually working together. So the federal prime minister needs to partner with the provinces, needs to deliver on vaccines, on rapid tests, needs to keep variants out of Canada.
Now, O'Toole also said a government under his leadership would have prevented the spread of the COVID-19 Delta variant through a number of means, including keeping Canada's borders closed.
All provinces have shifted and adjusted based on the various waves of the pandemic. But what the provinces have not had is a consistent and reliable partner in Ottawa. Mr. Trudeau fights with people. I will fight for Canadians. And we would never have let the Delta variant get its hold in Canada.
Meanwhile, as he promised again to make housing more affordable, NDP leader Jagmeet Singh took a few moments to talk about the COVID-19 crisis in Alberta, telling reporters the news coming out of the province is troubling.
We're going to push to call for the military and all supports possible to get out to Alberta to support the people. We're hearing from healthcare workers who have already been worked to the bone, who are saying that things are so desperate, now are saying that they don't know what's going to happen next because things are so bad there.
Alberta has 269 patients in intensive care in a system that's only set up for 173, and staff now are having to decide which patients will get treatment. Albertans also chiming in yesterday. Here's retired Calgarian Desmond Clark, who says the apology from the premier rings hollow and that he's lost all respect for Jason Kenney. He says his handling of the COVID crisis will not soon be forgotten, especially during the next provincial election.
I mean, he is, I think, shot himself in the foot. And next election, with him as still as leader, I don't think they would have a hope. You know, it's time maybe he's, if he doesn't go on his own, they might have to encourage him.
Now, Calgarian Jake Hughes, a business development representative, says he's exhausted and demoralized after 19 months of what he calls poor provincial leadership. He says it feels like the priority is businesses over people's lives.
Since the very beginning of this pandemic, it's been fumble after fumble, and it's hard to say I had faith in them to do the right thing to begin with, but it's just gotten worse and worse as we've continued.
Since July 1st, COVID hospitalizations have increased more than fivefold, with intensive care admissions reaching record highs in Alberta. And with 3 days now until the federal election, the main party leaders will be keeping the campaign throttle wide open today as they chase any undecided voters in Ontario, Quebec, and Nova Scotia.
Liberal leader Justin Trudeau is to begin his day with an announcement this morning in Windsor, Ontario. Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole will make an announcement in London this afternoon before moving on to St. Catharines for an evening event with supporters. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh starts out his morning in Sherbrooke, Quebec, talking about the Trudeau government's record on climate change. Singh also has stops planned in Sackville, Nova Scotia, and Halifax this afternoon. As the clock ticks down to Monday's election, the latest polling suggests that the race between the Liberals and Conservatives is still too close to call. Steve Henniger, the Canadian Press.
Time to get to our daily polls. Yesterday's poll question: what do you think will be the deciding factor in Monday's federal election? Strategic voting, the Liberal record, the pandemic, or the environment? And the Liberal record took the vote. 50% of respondents going with the Liberal record. Strategic voting and the pandemic, each getting 25% of the vote. The environment, though many people say is a concern, no respondents thinking that's going to be the deciding factor in Monday's election. I think that's pretty much bang on there. On to today's poll question. Health Canada has authorized brand name changes for the Pfizer-BioNTech, Moderna, and AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccines. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine will now be named Comirnaty. The Moderna vaccine will be named Spikevax. And the AstraZeneca vaccine will be named Vaxzevria. I don't get it. Should Health Canada have renamed these vaccines? Yes or no? It adds confusion. Daniel Panamondo, I'm going to start with you this morning because your reaction, your question to me this morning was absolutely just priceless. I thought this story was a joke. Was it?
So I saw this headline floating around yesterday, you know, Twitter, Reddit, wherever I frequent, and I legitimately thought it was, I didn't read it because I thought it was just a satire article from The Onion or something, or the Beaverton. Like, I didn't think anything of it. I thought it was just at first glance when I read it, I'm like, yeah, okay, that's, you know, kind of humorous. I'm like, you're right. I had to ask you today when I looked at the script. I'm like, wait, this is real? They're actually doing this with these names?
And they're terrible names.
It's like they pulled like 8-year-olds. Spikevax, yeah. You want Spikevax like jabbed in your arm? Like, it's just weird. Like, yeah. I don't know. At this point, when the world has already become accustomed to naming it after the manufacturer, it's like, what's the point? Like, I would be shocked if I run into one person out in the ether in the real world that actually uses these new names. I would be shocked.
Absolutely.
So my answer is clearly no. It adds confusion.
Yeah, I mean, you can't even, at first glance, you can't even pronounce them.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, Spikevax is pretty easy.
Spikevax is fine, but Vaxzevria and Comirnaty, I don't get it. Corinne Van Dusen, what do you think?
No, it definitely adds confusion, but I think it's going to come down to the tissue versus Kleenex, example. How many people just call them tissues? Kleenex is a brand name, and that's what you go with.
Yeah.
I agree with Daniel. I don't think anyone in the public is ever going to say, what do you got, Spikevax?
Yeah, exactly. Like, honestly, having just read them, if you come to me tomorrow and say, what's the brand name of the two? Because I got two different vaccines. What are the two brand names? What are the two new names? I don't know. Don't ask me.
I got Moderna and AstraZeneca. That's it.
They need words for all the different combinations that one person could have got. You know, like all the, they
yeah. need to, let's know. Combine Spikevax. Yeah. So I got the Spikezevria.
I don't know.
There you go.
Oh, crazy. Nice. I got a double Spikevax. I was double spiked. I'll call it that.
See, that sounds cool, though. I like that. Honestly, that sounds cool. You can vote on our Twitter poll and Facebook poll. Go to Facebook at Accessible Media Inc. Go to Twitter at AMI Audio. Have your say on today's poll question. We'll have the results for you on Monday. Right now, though, Corinne Van Dusen returns with your National Weather Report.
Here is your national weather forecast from Environment Canada. St. John's today, sunshine and 20 degrees. Halifax, mainly cloudy with a chance of showers or drizzle. Fog patches dissipating this morning. A high of 21, feeling like 26 with humidity. Montreal, a mix of sun and cloud. It's going to be a warm one with a high of 27, but a humidex of 34. In Ottawa, sunshine to start the day, then a mix of sun and cloud late in the afternoon with a chance of showers and risk of a thunderstorm. Fog patches dissipating this morning, high of 27, but feeling like 32. Toronto, sunshine, then a mix of sun and cloud with a chance of showers this afternoon, a high of 28, but feeling more like 35 with the humidity. Thunder Bay, a few showers ending this morning, then clearing, but there's also the risk of a thunderstorm early this morning, a high of 20. In Winnipeg, mainly sunny and a high of 18. Saskatoon, sun to start the day, then a mix of sun and cloud in the afternoon. Fog patches dissipating this morning and a high of 19. Calgary, a mix of sun and cloud and a high of 18. Same conditions in Edmonton, a mix of sun and cloud and a high of 18. Yellowknife, cloudy, but a mix of sun and cloud later this morning into the afternoon, a high of 11. In Vancouver, rain heavy at times, around 30 millimeters expected to fall, and a high of 15. And in Victoria, 10 to 20 millimeters of rain expected. Wind becoming southeast at 40 kilometers an hour near noon, but 60 near Harrow Strait in the afternoon, and a high of 15. That was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Corinne. When we come back after the break, we kick off our weekly news panel. We're going to discuss the COVID-19 crisis in Alberta and consider the interference of politics on public health policies. That's coming up next, now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. This is Now with Dave Brown. It's Friday, and that means we've reconvened the Now News panel, but with a couple of twists this week. So Dave is away. I will be taking his spot on the panel. And we are pleased to have Juwita Gupta, host of The Pulse, here with us this week. And as always, Michelle McQuigg, weekend national editor at the Canadian Press, rounds out our crew. So Juwita, welcome to the panel. Thanks for being here. We check Juwita. Hello, Juwita.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We've got you now. Excellent. And Michelle, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And nice to get the band back together from an old-timey incarnation panel.
That's right. Jumping in the old time machine for sure. All right. Our first topic is COVID-19 in Alberta. On Friday, June 18th, Jason Kenney declared that as of July 1st, Alberta would be, quote, open for summer. That meant health restrictions meant to protect Albertans from COVID-19 would be at their lowest threshold in months. It meant the Calgary Stampede would be held with crowds in attendance. It meant that, as Kenny put it, the end of this terrible time is just 2 weeks away. At the time, Dr. Noel Gibney, a professor emeritus in the Department of Critical Care Medicine at the University of Alberta, said reopening was risky. Gibney, who also serves as co-chair of the Edmonton Zone Medical Staff Association's Pandemic Response Committee, said the province needed to be careful to monitor cases and plan for the possibility of another clampdown. He said the rapid spread of the variant in the UK should serve as a warning and expected the Delta variant to become Alberta's dominant strain by the end of July and contribute to a surge of cases in September. Whether there's a fourth wave or a fourth bump, I think time will tell. We're going to see an increase in cases, but what that translates into is really the question. Now, the warning, among others, was not heeded, and earlier this week, Dina Hinshaw, Alberta's chief medical officer, admitted the reopening was premature.
The expectations did not match reality, and very shortly after we started that endemic path, we could see already from that comparison with actuals and the modeling data within a couple of weeks that we weren't seeing the decoupling we expected and really had to shift and walk back about, okay, we're not ready yet. We need to take more time. And as everyone knows, we've needed to put additional measures in place.
Alberta now has the highest active COVID case count in the country. It also set a record for intensive care admissions earlier this week at 202 people receiving critical care. On Wednesday, Premier Jason Kenney declared a public health emergency and says the province will bring in a COVID-19 passport. Kenney says he'd always been reluctant to bring in a passport program.
I had earlier committed not to introduce proof of vaccination because of concerns I had around privacy rights. But the government's first obligation must be to avoid large numbers of preventable deaths. We must deal with the reality that we are facing. We cannot wish it away.
But Kenny also pointed out, quote, "I don't apologize for not maintaining lockdown-style policies permanently, but I do apologize for having predicted we could open for good." Michelle, this is your topic, and let me start by asking, what kind of apology was that?
That's a good question, and one that a lot of people are asking themselves right now, because that has riled a lot of people. There's another very interesting component to this apology that you didn't mention that has come up in some other coverage, and that's the fact that he said that he feels a leader's job is to offer up some hope. He said that explicitly. So there seem to be a number of contradictory messages contained in there. You heard the clip just now about preventing deaths that could have been foreseen and that could have been stopped. And then in the next breath, you heard the rest of it, saying that he didn't apologize for maintaining lockdown measures permanently. It's an apology that's riled a lot of people, and the reversal itself is extremely striking on so many levels. Not only is it just a really shocking and horrifying case of what's happening right now in terms of COVID and how the fourth wave can spread in ways that it simply hasn't in other provinces with higher vaccination rates, but it's landing in the middle of a federal election. And as we know, provincial happenings can have ramifications on the federal trail. And this one is a particular one. The Liberals have been going after vaccines and conservative COVID response throughout the campaign. And then in this final week comes this glaring example of exactly the kind of worst case scenario they've been trying to paint throughout the campaign. And now people are having to respond to it on the double. We don't even know how it's going to impact election. In election day itself in Alberta on Monday. So ramifications all around, but also just a very interesting case study and all kinds of things that I thought we could sink our teeth into.
Yeah, I think the comment about hope sort of stood out to me, because you want to give hope, but I think leaders ultimately, first and foremost, have to offer reality. And truth, not just hope. I think hope sometimes can be kind of fleeting and unrealistic. Joita, was this a case of politics winning out over health policy?
I think the decision to open in the summer certainly was politically motivated. Remember that Jason Kenney is probably amongst the more libertarian premiers in the country and is of the belief, his personal belief, I think, is that there should be minimal government intervention in the lives of private citizens. And so less is more in his point of view. And under those circumstances, to an extent, when Jason Kenney's government reopened in the summer, they were, I believe, pandering to their base. If you think back to the apology, there is certainly an undercurrent of defensiveness around the decision to reopen in the summer. And of course, now, as you pointed out correctly, Mike, there's, on the one hand, what Jason Kenney might want himself, but I think buckling under pressure from his government, buckling under advice, and frankly, with reality creeping in, he's had to reverse course on this. At the end of the day, it was very interesting. And I watched with something akin to stunned disbelief over the summer, Dina Hinshaw basically saying that they were opening up. And I remember thinking back then, wait a minute, I don't think that's right. And I'm not an epidemiologist, so what do I know? But, you know, I still thought this isn't right. And so I don't know the backstory there, whether she buckled to political pressure or what was going on back there. But certainly in the summer, I think they made the transition away from treating this like a pandemic and treating it as though it was endemic far too quickly. And even Jason Kenney now acknowledges that.
I think you both know I'm, you know, usually the guy who puts a skeptic hat on, you know, before any other garb. And I'm with you. I'm with you, Juwita, on that. When I heard Jason Kenney talking about, you know, the this is all going to be gone in 2 weeks, and honestly, the joy with which he was declaring that the Calgary Stampede was going to be back, and the premier's flapjack breakfast and everything else was going to return, I just thought, wow, it seems like there's been just caution thrown to the wind, and we're just way, way, way too positive and energetic about this open for summer. Because to me, open for summer was so irresponsible that the new slogan has to be closed for fall. Like that's just a new slogan.
It certainly seems like it's heading that way, especially when you considered at the time that the vaccination rates within the province were lagging behind and continue to lag behind so many others. So at the time, it was very interesting to watch the Open for Summer plan be announced alongside a whole bunch of other reopening efforts elsewhere. When the vaccine rate, I don't remember what it was at the time, but I can certainly say that right now only about 72% of Albertans are fully vaccinated compared to north of 80% in many provinces. Mm-hmm. And certainly mm-hmm. almost 80% nationally. So that adds another layer of
yeah.
What's that all about?
Yeah.
And I think you're quite right to ask about Dina Hinshaw, and I assure you a lot of Alberta-based journalists are asking similar questions right now and are going to be trying to find out, and maybe stories will emerge in the months and years to come, maybe not. But that's certainly a question that some people are going to be occupying some time trying to solve.
But, Juwita, correct me if I'm wrong. I seem to remember a point earlier this year where there was a leaked piece of audio of Dina Hinshaw talking about political pressures being put on the Alberta Health Services and the people making the decisions. It was supposed to be coming from a place of science, and in fact, it was coming from a place of politics. Am I misremembering that?
No, and Michelle, you know, feel free to jump in and tell me if I'm misremembering. I do remember something like this taking place in the summer. In fact, I even remember the rumor that she was supposed to or was very close to resigning. And remember, to your point about the Calgary Stampede as well, that's another source of pressure. The economy was in a bit of a slump. It had been even before COVID-19. And I'm sure there was pressure coming from some quarters saying, we've got to reopen for business. We've got to have the Stampede coming in because that's a major source of revenue, and that I'm sure was part of what fed into the decision to open in the summer.
I think that that's a great point. Yeah, that's a great
point.
That
goes right back to your question about politics, about whether things are driven by health decision or political decisions. And I think there are seems to be noted when you look at the provincial response based on the partisan stripe of the government that's calling the shots. You do hear economic talk a lot more from conservative-led governments, even if they haven't all adopted the same policies. There definitely has been greater reluctance from conservative-led governments to either maintain public health measures or impose them in the first place or move to different levels of a lockdown. You have seen that play out time and again in the past 18 months, and now you're hearing it a lot on the campaign trail. It's definitely the drum that you're going to see some of the parties hitting the hardest into the home stretch, I think.
Yeah, certainly Alberta was a province that had a beat-up economy for a couple of years. And, you know, the just drive through Calgary and you notice and you hear about the number of vacancies in the downtown core, corporations that have shut down or moved away. It has not been a pretty scene for the last couple of years in Alberta. So, you know, that is absolutely a pressure point from a political standpoint that is quite real. And by no means are we questioning the reality of the economic pressures that Alberta's felt. But we're wondering about
the fact that political pressure and the economy wins out over public health measures. And really, I mean, when you think about the political landscape in this country, it feels like, you know, Alberta's not alone. It feels like places like Saskatchewan and Ontario and some of the Atlantic provinces as well sort of have that same political landscape, thus the same sort of reaction. But one thing that I can tell you, and just based on reading about Dr. Gibner's sort of prediction in Alberta back in June with regards to the Delta variant and saying, you know what, look at Great Britain and we should learn from them. It feels like we've should have at many points during this pandemic learned from what's happened in Europe, because it was always a couple of weeks. We were always a couple of weeks behind. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like we never, ever did, or very often did not, and end up suffering the consequences.
Yeah. Hard to disagree with that. That was certainly the case around the week before everything shut down here is when we started hearing about triage protocols being implemented in European countries, crowded hospitals in Italy. That's when all that footage started to circulate through. But it's the Alberta situation is just particularly striking in that not only now have there been international examples before everyone, but lots of domestic ones. We've had 13 different jurisdictions imposing 13 different sets of rules. There's been lots of collaboration among first ministers, and the federal government's been involved too. And even lessons unfolding closer to home have not necessarily been registered or been registered in ways that maybe some might not expect.
We heard a clip. Julia, I want to throw this to you. We heard a clip of in our top headlines this morning of a Calgary voter who says that the next election in Alberta is going to be a costly one for Jason Kenney, in his opinion. The next general election in Alberta is you know, legislatively set to happen between March 1st and May 31st, 2023. Is that enough time for Jason Kenney to erase this from the minds of Alberta voters, or do you think it sticks around?
Good question. So wasn't it Harold Wilson? Now, tell me if it was someone else, but wasn't it Harold Wilson who said that a week is too long in politics? So 2 years really is an eternity.
Yeah.
And a lot could happen in 2 years, right? Now, I'm going to forecast a couple of scenarios. In one scenario, we get done with COVID-19 in, oh, let's say 6 months, right? So you get done in 6 months. I think everything is forgotten and forgiven by voters. I think in that situation, Jason Kenney could recuperate. If, however, in a second scenario, we're a year and a half later, you know, and we're still dealing with COVID-19, voters in Alberta are going to look back on the summer and the hasty reopening, and then they're going to hold Jason Kenney accountable. The other thing to keep in mind is if you look back to what happened in 2015, how many of us were surprised that the NDP formed government in Alberta? If you look at the polls right now, the NDP is actually doing quite well. And one of the reasons that the NDP won in 2015 was because of vote splitting on the right, because there was a split in the party.
Yep.
So if right now, because of the decision to close, it causes this alienation amongst a portion of Jason Kenney's supporters, we might see another party form, which is far more to the right of Jason Kenney's Conservative Party, which could, again, down the road, lead to vote splitting in the next elections in Alberta, which would then open up the opportunity for the NDP to swoop in there and form government. The other thing I want to go back to is what Michelle said earlier, which is, you know, there's only about 72% of the population, which is below the national average, has gotten vaccinated. 72% is still not nothing. Mm-hmm. 72% is a majority of Albertans who have worn masks, gotten their vaccines, and are looking at Jason Kenney and going, you've dropped the ball here. Yeah. And those are people who are looking for an alternative. And that alternative could end up being the NDP, depending on how long the pandemic lasts.
Michelle, last word to you.
Yeah, I agree with Joita in that certainly in terms of time, he does have all the time he needs to theoretically recover. But so much depends on what plays out. And I think it's worth noting, too, that there already has been damage done by this pandemic. Even internally, there have been many caucus revolts. There have been splits within the UCP already. I think this situation is going to probably exacerbate those divides. I think the vaccine passport, or the rather proof of vaccination issue, is one that could continue to plague him, because that will not play very well at all with a big part of the base. And it represents a big reversal from a previously stated policy. So opposition parties have all kinds of ammo heading into 2023, whenever they do this election, regardless of how things play out in the coming months. And just the nature of the issues at hand here suggests to me that they're going to drag on long enough that perhaps that window for recovery is narrower than it looks right now.
I also think it goes beyond the opposition. I think if there's someone within that UCP party that has some leadership ambitions and sees some cracks in the armor of Jason Kenney, they may take advantage as well. So it'll be interesting to watch from within the party as well. A great start to the news panel. Up next, our next topic, the ethics and optics of anti-vaccination protests at Canadian hospitals. This is the Now News Panel on AMI. Welcome back. This is the Now News Panel on Now with Dave Brown. I'm Mike Ross, filling in for Dave. Michelle McQuigg is here from the Canadian Press. And Juwita Gupta, host of AMI Audio's The Pulse, is with us as well. Our second topic is about the demonstrations that have been happening outside hospitals across Canada in protest of COVID-19 vaccine mandates and public health measures. Juwita, what strikes you when you see who is protesting vaccine mandates and their reasons for doing so?
At the risk of stating the obvious, these protesters are clearly out of touch. They continue to protest loudly, vocally, even though, for the most part, public opinion is against them and science is against them. One of the things that's been interesting to see, because, and I see this quite, and I mean that in quite a literal sense, because these protesters, they go past my window like clockwork every Saturday afternoon en route to the hospitals. One of the things that it's been interesting to see, just anecdotally, is that their numbers have gotten smaller. And I suspect that the strategy to protest in front of hospitals has backfired. I think there's a lot of Canadians who might be vaccine hesitant, people who are on the fence, who are nonetheless appalled by the fact that they are standing there in front of a hospital, bothering patients, heckling healthcare workers. And I think they've lost a lot of ground in that respect. So really what it's done, I think, has alienated those who are vaccine hesitant from the hardcore anti-vaxxers as to why. Well, for one thing, historically, and I know this because I worked with our producer, Enrica Delanerol, on a vaccine miniseries way back when on The Pulse, one of the things to keep in mind is that there has been vaccine hesitancy and people who oppose to vaccines for as long as we've had vaccines. But more recently, and I don't think I need to belabor the issue, we're certainly dealing with more mistrust of government, more mistrust of authority. We're dealing with large numbers of people who are getting misinformation online, and they're going to be increasingly anti-fact, anti-science. And so that is a problem that is much harder to ferret out. But it's certainly a case where people have gone to obscure dark corners of the internet and gotten very radicalized. That's the upshot of it. And I think the people who are really bearing the brunt of this are patients and healthcare workers.
What about you, Michelle?
I strongly agree. And I think there's a lot of overlap between the demographics that we see out holding the signs in front of hospitals and staging these protests and those that we've been seeing following the Liberal leader around on his campaign tour. These are definitely a minority, but a particularly vocal one. And it's kind of remarkable. And I'm sure some would say very alarming to see how much of the spotlight they've been able to wrest from other people in recent weeks. But I agree with Joita's assessment of who they are, who they've been targeting, and how that strategy has really played out, because it has engendered a weird degree of unity, the kind of unity we're not used to seeing as people speak out against what they've been doing and to try to refute their messaging and try to put a stop to this. And yet it has continued. There was a big round on Monday. That's what we're talking about right now. This is basically a re-up of what happened a couple of weeks ago. And we might continue to see more, especially as the proof of vax systems start to kick in across more provinces.
I think for me, this is sort of a bit of a continuation of a topic that I brought forward on a previous news panel, which was
definitely
the Americanization of politics in Canada. And it just feels like this is Canadian Trumpism. That's what this is, has become. And I don't want to call it Bernierism because I don't know if Maxime Bernier is going to be around long enough, you know, post-pandemic, but that's a conversation for later. I just think that when I see these protests, and Michelle, I think you're right to point out, and Juita, about these folks protesting at hospitals, also protesting against Justin Trudeau, just feels like there's a lot of purple signs at these protests. And
yeah,
it seems like a very, very specific group of folks. It doesn't feel like it's a very a wide swath of Canadians that are part of this group. It feels very targeted.
Kind of expanding on what Juita was saying, I suspect the group of people who share some of the sentiments underlying the protests might be a little bigger. But the actual step of protesting hospitals, I suspect, Juita is right, is a bridge too far, even for some of the people who might feel that way.
Let me ask you this, Juita. The impact of on the morale of healthcare workers and patients, certainly, has been evident. I mean, they've been very vocal in responding. But what about the rest of us? I'm wondering what kind of impact these protests have had on you.
I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, personally, I've not needed to go to a hospital, but certainly if I did, this would make me very anxious. As it is, under these COVID conditions, I think people are nervous about seeking treatment at a hospital. They are worried about getting sick with COVID-19. You throw the protests into the mix, and I think it's going to make a lot of people who are immune compromised or people who are looking after people who are immune compromised very nervous about going to the hospital if they have a test or a procedure scheduled. It's just adding a lot of stress and pressure on healthcare workers, as you've noted, who have had 18, 19 months of working really hard to try and keep the ship afloat. So there's a lot that can be said about it. The one thing I'll note about the protesters, just going back to my earlier point about their numbers growing smaller, the one thing that we have to be really aware of is that those who are now left are really the hardcore militant protesters, and they're not going to back down no matter what. And what worries me is an escalation. So not only will they now be standing there silently, you know, protesting public policy, I'm actually worried about this escalating and becoming like a pushing for blockades or something. So the people who are left are going to dig their heels in, as it were.
Right. Who would possibly want to work in healthcare right now?
Yeah. A lot of people don't. A lot of people are leaving, even if they decided that they wanted to. And at some point, they're getting out. And it's not just the burnout. I think this really is contributing to it, or at least, or is a cherry on top of. It feels ungrateful, and that's what I think a lot of people are trying to express. They're saying, back when there were no other options, when there were no vaccines, we did everything possible to try and keep things going. We were taxed beyond our limits, and now this, no thanks. And I. Who would want to? I don't have an answer.
Not
I have
me.
No idea.
Not me.
Not
there,
me.
That's
sure.
my answer.
Yeah.
Not me.
Yeah.
Are there any arguments being presented by these protesters that you think are have any validity and will stick in the minds of Canadians and cause them to have real reflection moving forward?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's some of those.
I like the sound effect right off the top there. Yeah.
I mean, the argument that could just stick, hypothetically, is the civil libertarian arguments about,
you know,
do I have to get a vaccine or am I going to lose my job or, you know, now with the vaccine. So those are the arguments that might stick. But let's be honest. Let's, again, just do a bit of a reality check here. I think a lot of those arguments are going to get squashed because of the fourth wave, which is picking up steam in many parts of the country. We just talked about Alberta.
But let's be clear,
also,
though. Hang on just one second, though. Let's be clear. The government is not forcing anyone to get a vaccine. It feels like what these folks are really ticked off about is the vaccine passports and the inability. And I think this is important to really state clearly. They are ticked off at the temporary measures that are being brought forth, because, you know, 6 years from now,
when this is long gone, you will not have to produce a vaccine passport to get into a restaurant, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is a temporary measure that is being brought forth. I don't think anyone really believes that this is something that is going to last beyond COVID. Now, it may. I can't predict the future, but my gut tells me this is something that is going to help us get past this. Mm-hmm. And I think to a certain degree, even for those who are civil libertarians, it's much ado about a temporary measure to try and get us past a pandemic.
What did you do about nothing?
Yeah, well, I think you latched on to the fear that's driving people who feel this way, and that it won't be a temporary measure. But what is the basis of that? Questionable. And where are those arguments going to be sorted out if, in fact, they become necessary to sort out? Certainly not in front of hospitals. There's all kinds of other platforms and forums where these issues are being discussed already. And definitely, if you're looking for resolution, a hospital protest is not going to get it done. If we're looking at big-time libertarian questions like this, that's going to involve courts, constitutional experts, people who are probably not going to be joining you on the front steps of TGH.
Absolutely. Bang on. Juita, last word to you.
Well, I mean, I think it's not really this is not the conversation where we have a chat about vaccine passports, but I think you summed it up nicely, saying that it is just a temporary measure. And I think the key takeaway here is that as a strategy to try and raise the profile of the protests, it has certainly backfired to stand on the steps of a hospital and protest.
Thank you, Juita, for bringing this topic to the panel. After the break, our final topic today. How are you feeling about the 2021 federal election campaign? Are you happy? Are you angry? Are you frustrated? We're going to discuss that next. This is the Now News Panel on AMI. This is the Now News Panel on Now with Dave Brown. I'm Mike Ross, along with Juita Gupta, host of The Pulse on AMI Audio, and Michelle McQuigg, editor with the Canadian Press. Our final topic has to do with the 2021 federal election that's heading into its final weekend, with voting day set for Monday. I came across an article from CBC.ca that pointed out some of the lighter moments on the campaign trail. For example, when Green Party leader Annamie Paul accidentally endorsed the Liberals' plan on climate change at a press conference earlier this month and followed that up with a tweet saying, "That's one for the blooper reels." Or like when Erin O'Toole surrounded himself with dogs in making an announcement about puppy mills and domestic violence and announced he was a dog person. That caused a lot of cat people to gasp. But it's also been a campaign with low points and some personal attacks. So I want to know more globally off the top how you felt about this election campaign. I feel good overall. While I didn't think that this was an election that was necessary, given the ease with which the Liberals so far had in passing most of their legislative items, I do think there are more than a few precedents for a prime minister calling an election early in an attempt to take advantage of a weak or unsuspecting or unprepared opposition. I also think this election allowed Justin Trudeau, Erin O'Toole, and Jagmeet Singh to really show Canadians how different they are, how their politics differ from each other. So I guess generally I feel okay heading into Monday's election. I want to know how you guys are feeling. Michelle, I'm starting with you.
I'm just tired. Bear in mind, I have to engage with this stuff on a bit of a different level, and that on the weekends, I basically have to help run the election desk over the course of this campaign on top of the normal wire. So it is extremely tiring, but at the same time, I have an up-close vantage point to this, and I do find the whole thing a bit wearying. There's so much from this campaign that you could have predicted or scripted well in advance. Very few surprises in terms of policy shifts or talking points. As ever in a campaign, you're going to get down into some fairly tall weeds, for instance, if you're talking about the child care plans and the Liberal vision versus the tax credit initiative that the Conservatives are pitching versus what the NDP wants to do in terms of taxing the rich to raise some money to cover some of those costs. A lot of it gets pretty technical. So between the lack of surprises on the messaging front, the level of detail and scrutiny that you need to bring to bear on some of this in order to hash out what differences do exist, and some of the really low points that you mentioned. We've talked in the previous segments about the protesters following Justin Trudeau, about gravel being thrown at one of those events, about racist attacks against all candidates of all parties. There's been a lot to take in, and frankly, a lot of it is kind of exhausting.
Juita?
Yeah, I mean, I found it very interesting to be. I mean, I'm for someone who follows the news, on one level, I wasn't surprised that they called an election. I think Justin Trudeau and the Liberals were watching the situation play out in various provinces and thinking, well, here's an opportunity to try and turn that minority into a majority. I think the consensus is in that they've probably miscalculated on that score because now they're in a dead heat with the Conservatives. Yeah. On a different note, though, I have noticed less engagement, less about the elections on Facebook. And I think that has to do with the policy change at Facebook around dealing with misinformation during the election. But it could also just be the pandemic where people aren't as engaged. Certainly, late summer, that's, you know, you're dead in the water. People are just not interested. I think a lot of the interest in the election has really peaked after Labor Day. And that's, you know, when we get into the final stretch there. I think people tuned in to watch the election debates. And the last thing to keep in mind is that there is all of that protest, all of those protests happening. They've been getting a lot of coverage, as they should. But for the majority of Canadians, if there was a little bit of envy around the fact that the government called an election in the middle of a fourth wave, I think that probably lasted the first week and a half. I mean, there's only so long you can beat that particular drum, unless, of course, you are the Conservatives or the NDP that have to gain something politically by saying Justin Trudeau shouldn't have called an election right now.
So we've talked a lot about the Liberals, Conservatives, and NDP, but I want to get into two other parties in particular. Mm-hmm. The resurgence of the Bloc in Quebec. It really felt like, especially after the English leaders debate, where there was a particularly pointed question put to the Bloc leader about the perception of racism in Quebec. And that really fired up a lot of voters in the province. The numbers, poll numbers for the Bloc Québécois started going up. Mm-hmm. So immediately there's the question about the leader himself during that debate saying he has no interest in being a national leader for Canada, that he's only there for Quebec. Should he have even been on the leader's debate stage if you're only representing a party that is running in one province?
Shades of last week's debate reform conversation. Based on the current criteria, all I'm willing to say on this front is that based on the criteria that have been pretty clearly spelled out by the Debates Commission, they would have to be by virtue of the fact that they have MPs in the House, mm-hmm. that there were Bloc representatives in place at the time of dissolution. So on those grounds, you do automatically qualify to take place in a leader's debate. Questions as to whether or not that should be allowed to happen, well, that's a whole other can of worms, but it's far from unique, and they're far from the only regional party. The Maverick Party is mounting a bit of a push out west right now, and I'll be interested personally to see how the COVID reversals and the decisions that got made out there in Alberta will play out for the Maverick Party, especially now that there's calls for federal aid and whatnot. But it's always going to be an interesting question with Quebec. The resurgence of the Bloc is notable, and I think, if anything, it's going to have particular ramifications for the Liberals, and that will be very interesting to see on Monday.
Juita, what about the arrival of the People's Party of Canada? And nearly now 7 or more percentage points of popularity nationally across the country.
Yes, it's so interesting. One of the things I'd wanted to mention in our previous segment around the protests is that I think one of the side effects, if you want to call it that, of these hospital protests and the crystallizing of the anti-vaxxer movement is a great deal of organized support for the People's Party of Canada. Where is the support from the People's Party of Canada coming from? It's the far-right conservatives who are moving to vote for the PPC. And yes, you're right, they have gained a lot of support. I was walking home the other day and I saw a bunch of of signs up for the People's Party. They are definitely making a presence, and that is going to hurt the Conservatives in the long term, not to mention the fact that, you know, the Conservatives are losing favor on the one hand there, but the People's Party sort of eating away at their support. But they haven't really been the strongest when it comes to the pandemic anyway, so they're probably going to lose some of their more moderate members as well. So, yeah, the People's Party, I think, is really interesting to see how that has gained so much momentum and so much steam. But the people are going to be hurt by that are the Conservatives, and obviously the Liberals will probably gain as a result of that.
It's going to be curious to me to see how much they can sustain themselves as a party post-COVID, because it really feels like, though they had some grassroots in the last election, it really felt like they gained a lot of steam with the anti-vax and the anti-mask and the anti-COVID mandate movement. So let me just wrap up here, because we've got about a minute left here. Just getting a prediction from you on Monday's election, Juwita.
Well, I think we'll probably see another minority parliament, but with the Liberals probably getting first dibs because they are the incumbents. If they may end up having the most seats, I think, but even if they don't, because they're the incumbents, they'll be the first in line to test the confidence of the House. So I predict a Liberal minority with the possibility, I'm not saying that's set in stone, of a coalition with the Greens and or the NDP.
All right. Michelle?
I think it's going to be a Liberal or a Conservative minority. I don't foresee any likelihood of a coalition government. We've actually had a couple of leaders indicate that they're not willing to go down that road at all. For me, the writings I'll be watching on Monday that will help me land on a final prediction will be the 905 reading, writings, all the ones surrounding the Toronto area. There's been a pattern in recent elections of so goes the 905, so goes the result. Mm-hmm. And that has been consistent. When they go Liberal, that's who wins. If they go Conservative, they've got it locked up. So that plus Quebec, as you rightly mentioned earlier, the Bloc's resurgence there will be extremely interesting to see. And a path to any kind of majority does, in fact, run through Quebec. So yet another reason to support the minority predictions from two of three of us. How about you, Mike?
Yeah, I'm in lockstep with both of you. It's going to be a minority government. And at this point, I really do need to see what Monday looks like. But I get a feeling like it's going to be a flip of the coin, really, between the Liberals and the Conservatives. Thank you to both of you for being here. Great animated news panel. Appreciate it. And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Now with Dave Brown, we'll continue with our second hour just around the corner. Stick around. Welcome back. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. It is Friday, September 17th, 2021. I'm Mike Ross, filling in for Dave Brown. In this second hour of the program, our entertainment critic Michael McNeely will continue his coverage on TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival, and AMI's communication specialist Greg David gives us the scoop on the 73rd annual Primetime Emmy Awards. That and lots more coming up Now with Dave Brown. But first, we kick off the hour with Corinne Van Dusen and your regional news headlines.
Thanks, Mike. Starting in British Columbia, where the health ministry says over 86% of people hospitalized with COVID-19 in BC during the first 2 weeks of September were not fully vaccinated. It recorded 706 new cases of the virus yesterday, along with four more deaths, to total 1,877 fatalities in the province since the start of the pandemic. The Northern Health Region has the highest number of cases per capita, and Health Minister Adrian Dix says that's a reflection of lower vaccination rates that have driven up hospitalizations there. A modeling group that includes experts from three universities in BC says the northern region's cases are growing in a similar way to those in Alberta, which has declared a public state of emergency. In the prairies, Alberta is getting offers of medical help as it grapples with a COVID-19 surge that could buckle its health system. Dr. Verna Yu, head of Alberta Health Services, says the province is in talks with the Ontario government to help deal with an intensive care system that is operating 155% over normal capacity. Newfoundland and Labrador Premier Andrew Fury has also offered aid. There have been massive cancellations of non-urgent surgeries across Alberta as staff are reassigned to COVID care. Alberta has regularly seen more than 1,000 new COVID-19 cases a day for weeks, and there were a total of 18,706 active cases in the province yesterday. The CEO of the Saskatchewan Health Authority says the province's healthcare system is in critical condition. Scott Livingstone says it will do what it can to handle rising cases of COVID-19 and the strain those cases are putting on hospitals. He says in the coming weeks, the organization will be tested like it has never been tested before. The province reported 439 new COVID-19 cases yesterday, the fifth straight day of daily total that exceeds 400. In Ontario, Western University students set to walk out of class today to protest the school's handling of a spat of recent allegations of sexual assault. Western and London police have said four women have come forward with formal complaints about being sexually assaulted on campus in recent days. Police are also investigating allegations made on social media of mass drugging and sexual assaults on campus. The school says it will require students and residents to take training sessions on sexual violence and consent. It is also offering counseling and conducting an investigation into the various incidents that occurred during orientation week. The Toronto International Film Festival says an audience member has tested positive for COVID-19. The TIFF organization says its customer relations team was informed of the positive COVID test, but the festival offered no details on how many or which screenings were involved. The organization says the case is considered low risk due to all the COVID protocols in place. Several festival goers posted screenshots on Twitter of emails they received from the TIFF organization, which suggested affected audience members may want to get tested. Affected screenings include Dune, The Humans, and Bergman Island at Scotiabank Theatre. And in Atlantic Canada, the Nova Scotia Nurses Union will be protesting in Dartmouth today to express mounting frustration among overworked frontline nurses. The group says they're calling on governments to address the nurse shortage. The demonstration is being held by the Canadian Federation of Nurses Unions and will also include its member organizations from across the country. The union says after 18 months of the COVID-19 pandemic and over a decade of nursing shortage, its members are looking for meaningful change. And those are your regional news headlines.
Thank you very much, Corinne. Appreciate that. Now time for a sports chat as we head into the weekend with Jeff Ryman. All right, Jeff Ryman, what have you got planned here for the weekend?
Ooh, that's a very good question there, Rossi. We're starting to get into the swing of things with sports as everything's starting to come back. I mean, we talked about hockey. It's just around the corner. We're not quite there yet, but we're getting there. And football. Football is back, and it was good to watch last week. It was good. I guess if you're a fan of New York or Washington or had fantasy implications, yesterday would have been a good game for you. Didn't quite pique my interest, but, you know, football is back, Rossi, and obviously baseball in full swing, pun intended, with the Blue Jays starting a three-game set against the Minnesota Twins. So it's going to be fun to see how things shape up this weekend. Of course, the Blue Jays 0.5 game, so just half a game above, I believe, the Boston or the New York Yankees for that final wild card position in the AL. Things are really, really tight. We saw the Yankees win some, and they actually lost yesterday against the Baltimore Orioles in extra innings. I don't know what it is with Baltimore, but I believe they've been playing spoiler for a bunch of teams lately, heading into extra innings twice against the Yankees. And the Boston Red Sox, they get to go against those Baltimore Orioles this weekend as well. So it's kind of a smorgasbord of things on my schedule, Rossi. I'll be watching the Blue Jays very closely, of course. Hyunjin Ryu gets the start tonight against the Twins. First pitch at 7:10 p.m. Eastern time. And again, you know, the Blue Jays have been on a roll. I think they've won 8 of their last 10. And they want to keep those good times going. And they get to do it against potentially a not so good team. They're at the bottom of the AL Central, those Minnesota Twins. So the Blue Jays, you know, looking to continue to pad their lead in that wild card position there, Rossi.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so excited to have really meaningful baseball. being played now into the latter half of September, right? Like, it's one thing if it was September 1st, September 2nd, and you're looking at a whole lot of runway still left to go. But this is now into the second half of September, and the Blue Jays are very much in this. And there's just so much to be excited about with this team, and how, you know, for example, like a Bo Bichette. Here's a guy who's just been on fire of late, who just, what, a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago, people were basically writing off his season and saying, that's too bad. 2021's been a bit of a disappointment for him. There's the disappointment of the injuries to Kevin Biggio. But then Bichette suddenly turns things around. He's like this surprise, this shining light all of a sudden. You got Robbie Ray, who's just been phenomenal to watch this year. I've absolutely loved watching him. And I can't really think of a single instance this season where it's felt like, that was a bad outing by Robbie Ray. Like, it's just been so positive.
Yeah, I mean, this guy is definitely in that Cy Young category right now. I mean, just the ERA, I know the wins are starting to creep up there now. Then he's getting a little bit of run support. But the ERA, the strikeouts, the innings pitched, the quality starts that he's been able to put together over the course of this season, I believe is first in the major league. If not, he's in the top two or three. I mean, this guy has been phenomenal so far this year. Alek Manoah, again, another bright spot we've touched on a couple times this year. He gets a start, I believe, this series against Minnesota as well. So the Blue Jays definitely looking to pad their position in that wild card. But Rossi, there's also football going on this weekend as well. Week number two officially underway. Of course, last night the Washington football team came away with a 1-point victory over the New York Giants. And things obviously continue on Sunday and on Monday. Rossi, I'll give you my go-to game for this week, and it has to do with a team that was maybe a little bit surprising in the terms of injuries. We're definitely hitting them before the season even started, but I think a lot of people expected them to win last week, and they didn't. And I'm going with Kansas City Chiefs and the Baltimore Ravens. The Ravens, the team I was just talking about, they're 0-1. Kansas City looked very, very good. I mean, Patrick Mahomes didn't miss a beat. Tyreek Hill, this guy almost put up again almost 200 point or 200 yard outing in terms of receiving yards. He was just all over the field. Such a dynamic offense coming from Kansas City. And this is the Sunday nighter, so it's basically in the spotlight, prime time Sunday night. You can watch this game just all by itself. You don't have to worry about any other games sort of interfering with this. So that's where I'm spotlighting and probably going to watch a lot on Sunday night, Kansas City and Baltimore.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Miami and Buffalo. A good AFC East matchup. A lot's been made about, you know, Buffalo and the expectations this year that they're going to be winning the division, but that, you know, where's Miami at? Are they ready to push for top spot in that division? It's going to be a big game for both those teams, so I'm really looking forward to that. By the way, Washington last night, they were the team that I'd originally picked in my survival pool, and we only have one strike in this year's pool. And I thought about it yesterday. I thought, I got to change that. I don't like the feel of it. And I forgot to change it. And so it was Washington. And I was like, whoo, when I saw that point, that kick go through for the for the point, I was like, oh, thank goodness gracious. So I managed to survive for a second week on that Washington win. So pretty pumped up for that. But lots of action going on this weekend, Jeff. Enjoy it, and I know you'll have a recap for us on Monday.
Sounds good, man. Have a good weekend.
All right, you too. Jeff Ryman and our sports chat. There's more sports talk coming up later today, 4 o'clock Eastern, on the Neutral Zone, as Brock Richardson and the rest of the crew are going to speak with Adam Dukovich, the technical delegate for the London Cannonballs Bocce Blast Tournament. Together, they're going to discuss the 30th anniversary of the event. It comes your way today, 4 o'clock Eastern, 1 o'clock Pacific, on AMI Audio. Time now for a check on the weather. Here's Corinne Van Dusen.
Thanks, Mike. Here's the AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. Corner Brook, Newfoundland, mainly sunny. Fog patches dissipating this morning and a high of 17. Charlottetown, PEI, sunny. Fog patches dissipating, a high of 23 with a humidex of 25. The high along parts of the coast will be 19. St. John, New Brunswick, mainly sunny, then clouds roll in this afternoon. Fog patches dissipating this morning, high of 22, feeling like 27 with the humidity. Quebec City, sunshine, then a mix of sun and cloud near noon. Fog patches dissipate this morning, high of 24, feeling more like 30 with the humidity. In Toronto, sunny, then a mix of sun and cloud with a chance of showers this afternoon, high of 28, but a humidex of 35. Sault Ste. Marie, sunshine, then clouds roll in near noon with showers, a high of 24, humidex 29. Brandon, Manitoba, mainly sunny and a high of 18. In Regina, sunshine, then a mix of sun and cloud this afternoon, a high of 19. Lethbridge, Alberta, a mix of sun and cloud and a high of 19. And in Red Deer, a mix of sun and cloud, high of 18. In Whitehorse, mainly cloudy today with a high of 10 degrees. And in Kelowna, cloudy, chance of showers this afternoon, a high of 17. Vancouver, rain heavy at times, about 30 millimeters expected to fall with a high of 15. And that was your National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
All right. Thank you very much, Corinne Van Dusen, who will return later on in the hour with a look at this day in history. Coming up next, entertainment critic Michael McNeely continues his coverage on the Toronto International Film Festival. But first, there's a new Apple Watch for fans to buy. But just how long will they have to wait for the watch? Here's reporter Michelle Franzen with Tech Trends.
Andrew Martinick is the editor-in-chief of Digital Trends. He says the design changes to the Apple Watch Series 7 are subtle but noticeable.
It's a 0.2-inch larger screen, but, you know, when you're looking at something on your wrist, it makes a big difference. And they've kind of adjusted the software at the same time to push everything out so you get more text on the screen.
It also adds some updates for cyclists.
They have new fall detection, so if you fall off of your bike, the Apple Watch will call emergency services automatically for you at a certain point.
But as 9 to 5 Max Chance Miller explains, there was one thing missing from the Series 7 presentation this week.
We don't have an actual release date yet. They just said available sometime this fall, which there had been some reports of some production problems, so that'll be interesting to watch.
With Tech Trends, I'm Michelle Franzen, ABC News.
Welcome back. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Mike Ross, filling in for Dave. And as we do on Fridays, time to check in with Michael McNeely. Now, the 45th or 46th annual Toronto International Film Festival is happening now, runs until the 18th. The 10 days of the festival features close to 200 films from across Canada and around the world. Our entertainment critic, Michael McNeely, has been covering the festival, and he joins us from his family residence in Kingston, Ontario. Hello, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
I am great. It is wonderful to talk to you again. Today, we're going to focus on the accessibility of the festival. So how's it been so far, in your opinion?
I think it's been good in some parts, and it's needed enough improvement in others. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to talk a little bit more about that. I think one of the biggest challenges is, although everything does have subtitles or closed captioning, the subtitles and closed captioning can be hard to see sometimes.
What accessibility features are in place this year?
So, as I mentioned, we do have closed captioning and subtitles for all the films and all the presentations, such as the talks by celebrities. However, I've noticed that as a journalist, I also have some access to industry and marketplace screenings, and those don't appear to have closed captioning for me, although it's not necessarily that I would need to see those. I just wondered if they were accessible, that's all. We don't have any films with audio description, which means that many of us at AMI would not be able to watch these films, unfortunately. We don't have anything for people with autism or people who need a low sensory area. And I've also asked about the accessibility of in-person screenings, but I haven't received any information about that. So I find that a bit concerning as well.
Could anything else be improved while the festival is in progress?
The festival is just about to come to a close right now, and I can only imagine how stressed and overworked the staff are. And that's one of the recommendations that I want to make in a future question that you're going to ask me, Dave. So right now, it's unlikely that much improvement could occur at this stage.
Okay, you helped with a report commissioned by Inside Out in Toronto this past year. Can you talk a little bit about the findings in the report?
Yes, so the report is about creating a culture of accessibility. What does that mean? What does that look like? And we did some case studies based on different organizations that we thought did have a culture of accessibility, but were not disability-led organizations. For example, AMI would not qualify because AMI is already considered to be targeting a specific disability or disabilities. But in the case of TIFF, it's just a cultural organization that doesn't necessarily have any disabilities in mind, but, you know, should be accessible for everyone regardless. So the purpose of our report was to see the organizations that were not disability-led but still had a culture of accessibility, still went out of their way to help people with disabilities access their services. We wanted to find out, you know, what motivated them to do this work and what kinds of strategies they had for being accessible. And we found out that building a culture of accessibility starts from within. It usually starts from one or two staff members or volunteers becoming passionate about disability, becoming passionate about accessibility. And why did they become passionate? Maybe it's because they had a family member or a friend that had a disability. Maybe it's because they had a disability themselves. It doesn't matter why they became passionate, but they were usually the initiators of a movement from within the organization to become more accessible and more accountable for people with disabilities. So I think that was one of the main key findings. And then the second key finding that I would like to share with you is the importance of consulting people with disabilities, the importance of making sure that their voices are heard, and making sure that they know that their voices are heard so that they feel valued and able to contribute to the organization's goals and mandates. And it's also very important that when we hear people with disabilities consulting or putting forward their opinions, it's important that we value their work, maybe perhaps financially, well, with some kind of contribution that allows them to enjoy what the organization has to offer.
What would you want TIFF to implement as a result of this report? Knowing that TIFF is a different organization than Inside Out or the other organizations discussed in the report.
I think, first of all, I know that TIFF means well. I know that they're generally trying to be accessible. I just wish that they could go forward more with those attempts at being accessible. I would like to see them, you know, talk more about how they're being accessible and what kinds of features they're implementing. So, for example, I did ask about the accessibility of in-person screenings, and I didn't receive an answer. So even if the in-person screenings were accessible, I wouldn't know about them. And that's frustrating, because what is the point of having an accessibility feature if you're not letting the community know that those accessibility features are in place? And another thing that I would want to have implemented at TIFF is the consultation, necessary consultation with people with disabilities to ask them what they want from a film festival, what they expect from a film festival, and, you know, what are some of the success parameters we would have to ensure that each year we're making progress from the year before in terms of becoming more accessible. Because I think there's just a lack of communication between TIFF and accessibility community members. And I feel that's unfortunate, because if there was greater communication, there would be greater use of TIFF's services, I believe. And finally, I think with this consultation in place, I would be able to talk to TIFF, amongst other people, of course, but I would mention that the closed captioning in the subtitles are difficult to see, and that they should be doing more audio description, because they're currently not doing any right now.
In your opinion, what do you think is stopping a film festival as big as TIFF from mandating their films be accessible with captioning and description?
I think the biggest thing is a fear or a reluctance to talk to the distributors. The distributors are the ones that publish the films. And there needs to be a partnership between them, because if the film festival doesn't get films, then of course you can't have a film festival. But at the same time, the film festival is the one that's accepting these films. And they're the ones that are saying it's okay to accept these films that do not have accessibility features in them. So I believe that's one of the big issues. And if we can talk to the distributing companies, then they may recognize the importance of having accessibility features in the films. However, it's been brought to my attention that many filmmakers are, you know, rushing to get their films done, that some of them may have their films done the day before the film festival actually starts. And so I think things have to be changed in terms of that timeline. I think accessibility needs to be integrated from the very beginning, so that it's not an afterthought and it's not part of a rush job. So those are some of my observations from my perspective.
All right. I can't let you go without discussing some more films. So tell us about Encounter, starring Riz Ahmed from The Sound of Metal.
Yes. So Encounter is a very interesting film as it changes genres. So I don't want to talk too much about the storyline, as I might give out or I might give away what actually happens. But ultimately, at the beginning, Riz Ahmed plays a father who has some military experience and is a sort of scientist. And he believes that we're going to be under a pandemic, not the COVID pandemic, but a pandemic in which bugs have taken over our bodies. So he believes that we're being taken over by parasites. And he has two children. He's separated from his wife. And so he doesn't think that his wife is taking care of the children during this pandemic. And that's all I want to mention. But it is a great road trip film. And I really appreciated the bond that you find exists between the father and the children. And also Octavia Spencer is in the film, and she does a great job as well.
Okay. Another interesting film was You Are Not My Mother, which is about a mother that may be having some bad days as a result of mental illness or possession.
Yes, and Mike, I am not your mother. I know that. but ultimately, it's the story of three generations of an Irish family, and the mother is, as you mentioned, she's not doing well. And this is kind of a story of mental illness, but it's also more of a story of Irish folklore and superstition. With regards to the mental illness aspect, I would have appreciated more details about the mental illness because one of the issues we have when we talk about films with disability is often disability is generalized and there's not enough specifics. So it's not clear what kind of mental illness this person has. And as a result, we become afraid of that person because there's things that we don't know, whether anything could happen. But at the same time, this is also a demon possession film. So I'm not sure how well my criticisms could hold if someone's been possessed by a demon. Then basically, it doesn't matter about the mental illness aspect. However, I would mention that this film started off interesting. It had some really good scares, but ultimately I found the plot holes to be too distracting for my liking. And so I ended up sort of giving this movie a mixed review, but I did want everyone to know about it because of the mental health aspect.
Michael, some great insight, some great information on not only the movies, but on TIFF. We really appreciate it. Have fun at the remaining days of the Toronto International Film Festival. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me, and I'll be back to normal next week. I'll be rested up, and we'll talk about films that everyone can see.
Fantastic. Thank you. Michael McNeely, our entertainment critic, discussing this year's Toronto International Film Festival, which is running now until September 18th. For more information, visit tiff.net. When we come back after a quick break, lots more. Now with Dave Brown coming your way as we wrap up the week here on AMI. Welcome back. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Mike Ross, filling in for Dave, who returns on Monday. Time now for our big business story of the day. And Corinne Van Dusen is on the beat today. What do you got?
Well, we're going to talk shopping, but we only have the American numbers so far. Canadian numbers will be coming out later in the month. Americans apparently kept shopping last month. Despite the rise in COVID-19 cases, the U.S. Commerce Department reports retail sales rose a seasonally adjusted 0.7% in August from the previous month, but much better than the 0.85% decline Wall Street had expected. Today's report does show a shift in how the Delta variant has changed where Americans spend their time and money. Online sales soared 5.3% last month, while sales at restaurants and bars were flat from the month before. It'll be interesting to find out what's happening in Canada with the Delta variant surges in different places. But doesn't surprise me that online shopping has come back into vogue, I guess, as they say. I was thinking about it, and the only online shopping that I really still do is ordering groceries, because I really found that that's a great thing to order everything and then just go pick it up. You don't have to stay in there. But turns out I ordered absolutely everything in the world during the pandemic, so I don't need to do anymore.
I found a couple of things that I still am ordering online. And one of them is mouthwash, because the mouthwash brand that we buy, I like the one that's alcohol free, and I found it online for about $3 to $4 cheaper per bottle. Compared to what we're paying at the pharmacy, where we normally buy it, and really anywhere else that you can find it. So that's one that's remained a constant for me. That until I see a price switch there, I'm sticking with it. I'm not switching off of the online stuff.
I think a lot of people found different deals online compared to just popping into the store and grabbing it, which is a good thing. My interest now is, since we're to the end of September, I hate to use the Christmas word, but Christmas is coming up. So are online sales going to go up again, or are retail stores and online kind of going to balance out?
Well, you bring up a great point, too, because I forget where I saw it this morning, but someone had pointed out that with supply chain issues still very much present, that folks might want to do some early holiday shopping, even if it is online. Get in there ahead of the rushes that'll happen later on this year, because the supply chain issues may mean that those delays sort of stand up, and you might be facing a bit of a crunch if you try and order too late into the season. So I think you bring up a very valid point.
I used to be someone who would shop throughout the year. And my Christmas shopping would start around now, but I was out and about and walking around, and if I saw something, I'd just pick it up. But last year, obviously, not doing that. This year, I haven't started yet, so. But
so we have a Christmas.
Don't tell any family or friends.
We have a Christmas box, and we do just like you. We see stuff over the year, and if that's a great gift for so and so, buy it. Mm-hmm. Goes into the box. That way it's not tucked away like in Christmas Vacation where he discovers a gift, 20 years later.
I was just thinking that.
Yeah, that was us at one point where it was like, didn't we buy it? And then you find it like 6-7 months later and go, oh, man, forgot to give it to so-and-so. So the Christmas box comes in very handy. All right, Corinne, thanks for that. But stick around, because Corinne Van Dusen is here to give us this day in history, the now event.
September 17th, 1984, Conservative Brian Mulroney was sworn in as Canada's 18th Prime Minister. Mulroney's 40-member cabinet became Canada's largest in history, and he was Prime Minister for 9 years. In 1985, the tainted tuna scandal erupted as the CBC Public Affairs Program, the Fifth Estate, revealed that 1 million cans of rancid and decomposed tuna had been distributed to Canadian supermarkets. Scandal rocked the Conservative government as it was learned the tuna had been approved by Fisheries Minister John Fraser after inspectors had ruled it unfit for human consumption. The government recalled the tuna 2 days later, and Fraser later resigned. And in 1999, the Supreme Court of Canada acquitted Donald Marshall Jr. on 3 charges of illegally catching eels, saying the 1760 treaty with the British gave his Mi'kmaq band the right to catch fish and sell them for sustenance. And that, as we say, is an now of then.
Interesting how two of those items, one didn't really impact anybody long term as far as John Fraser's political career, because he went on to become Speaker of the House of Commons just a few years later. And the Donald Marshall Jr. decision continues to reverberate today with the Mi'kmaq fishery in the Atlantic region, which continue to push for their treaty rights, and a lot of people pushing back on that. And they say, no, sorry, go back to 1999. The decision's been made. So that continues to reverberate to today. Corinne, thank you very much. Appreciate that look back.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. There goes Corinne Van Dusen. And here comes Daniel Panamondo with your entertainment report. All right, Daniel, what do you got today for us?
Lots of people talking in the entertainment world about the new Guillermo del Toro movie called Nightmare Alley. It's been in production for quite a long time, and a lot of kind of prying eyes and industry insiders always kind of have their antennas out for his next project, because very visual director, Oscar-winning director, lots of people love his movie. So we finally have a little teaser trailer, again, for Nightmare Alley, and I don't know if it's the fact that it is just a teaser trailer and not the full-length trailer, but viewing it myself, I couldn't even really tell what the movie was about. I haven't been keeping tabs on it, really, but I gave it some more thought, and I actually kind of like that. Don't you hate when trailers, you can tell what the movie is just from the 2-minute trailer? You see all the plot points, you know where it goes, they show bits of the ending. I hate that. So I kind of like that it's vague a little bit, and hopefully they keep it a little vague going forward for the next trailers. But if you're curious about what it's about, Nightmare Alley stars Bradley Cooper, a nightclub mind reader who becomes tangled up with Cate Blanchett, who is a psychiatrist out to debunk him as a fraud. Now, the trailer itself manages to be plenty tense without Guillermo del Toro's usual monsters, featuring carnival sideshows. Willem Dafoe is also in it as some kind of ringleader, etc., etc. So it's got a pretty star-studded cast. Lots of people excited for Guillermo del Toro's Nightmare Alley.
All right, Daniel, appreciate that. Stick around, though, because Daniel has one more report to deliver, and that is what's trending.
Number one trend today. Don't worry, it's not Nicki Minaj, although it is another female musical artist. Taylor Swift is trending pretty hard. As you recall, she's been involved in a lot of legal kerfuffle, which led to her announcing that she is re-recording all of her albums. So she actually dropped the first single. She already dropped the re-release of her first album. Now she's in the process of releasing her second album, the re-recording of it anyway. And so she dropped the first single from it, which is Wildest Dreams. It was a massive hit when it first came out 6 years ago. And the updated take, which is labeled Wildest Dreams Taylor's Version for legal reasons, is barely different from the original, which I'm sure many people will appreciate, and surely appease many followers and anger those who own the rights to her original albums. And like I mentioned, she's in the process of re-recording her entire catalog, her six full-length albums, to kind of own the music again, because she, as of now, doesn't own her first original releases. So lots of people excited about that, and the full album coming out in November. So lots of people talking about Taylor Swift.
All right, Daniel, appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Time to find out what's coming up today on Kelly and Company, 2 o'clock Eastern Time on AMI Audio. And we've got Ramya Amuthan joining us this morning. Hello, Ramya.
Hey, Mike. How's it going?
I'm very good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's a Friday.
It is. Yes, thank goodness it's here. And you guys, just like us, you guys don't take Friday off. You look forward to the weekend, but another busy Kelly and Company.
That's right. We're talking about Apple devices because there's a lot coming out. WWDC, of course, the Worldwide Developers Conference with Apple, giving us so much news. So we're going to talk about the announcements with John Beeler of the App Show. Also, CNIB Night Steps events are coming up, and there's one taking place in Victoria, BC, that we're going to learn about with Sylvie Fiquette, our colleague over there. Also, we're talking to Ryan Huey on the Chatty Bookshelf about a new fantasy series that is getting the, quote, on the bus edition treatment. So, not sure exactly what this means, but we'll find out on the Chatty Bookshelf.
All right, looking forward to it. Thank you for that. Have a great show and have a wonderful weekend.
You too, Mike.
Thank you. Ramya Amuthan and Kelly and Company, 2 o'clock Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific time on AMI Audio. Coming up after the break, AMI's communications specialist, Greg David, will give us the scoop on the 73rd Annual Primetime Emmy Awards. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back to Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Mike Ross. Every couple of weeks, we present The Scoop with Greg David. He's our communications specialist here at AMI, and Greg is joining us from his home in Chelsea, Quebec. Good morning, Greg.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
I'm great, thank you. Wonderful to have you back here on the show. Last week, Greg, Mary Mammoliti stopped by to announce her latest AMI project, Dish with Mary. And I'm just hoping you can just remind people who Mary Mammoliti is and what Dish with Mary is all about.
Wow. Mary Mammoliti, she's a home cook. She is a member of the Blind and Partially Sighted community. She does a podcast for AMI called Kitchen Confession. She's part of the AMI This Week group. And she has segments on Kelly and Company every other week. And now she's got a brand new show called Dish with Mary that debuted last night on AMI TV.
I tuned in. It was awesome. I just wonder if the recipe that was featured last night and the recipes that are going to be featured on the show, are they going to be available for viewers at home? Are they going to be able to get them after the program? Where do they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was a chicken risotto that was made, and upcoming recipes, there's going to be a pork tenderloin recipe with another chef. There's going to be a Mexican lasagna. If you go to AMI.ca look for it's AMI.ca/dish-recipes. We're going to be putting the recipes up there on the website every week. So the one for chicken risotto with Chef Paul Schufelt was just uploaded today because I uploaded it.
Fantastic. Thanks for doing that. Now, it premiered last night on AMI TV. Is that the regular night for people to catch it?
Yep, absolutely. So Dish with Mary airs every Thursday night at 8:30 p.m. on AMI TV. And if you miss the episode, you can always head to AMI.ca to get the episode there or the handy and free AMI TV app for Android and Apple.
Well, congratulations to Mary, and we wish her all the best. I look forward to trying out that recipe for risotto because up until last night, I was quite intimidated. I think a lot of home chefs are intimidated with making risotto. It just doesn't seem that easy, but with Mary's help, I think I can.
Yeah, you're right, Mike. That's one of the most daunting recipes. I've never tried to make it because it talks about stirring constantly, adding a cup of stock, adding another cup of stock. And so, yeah, in last night's episode, they really did demystify it and make it a lot easier. You're right. I'm going to tackle it, too.
Let's turn our attention now then to the wider world of TV, to a show that has a lot of people buzzing, Greg. It's the 73rd annual Primetime Emmy Awards. The awards taking place this Sunday night on CBS. And this is really a celebration of all things television. Who is hosting the event this year? And is it, are they going back to the traditional sort of awards show pre-COVID-19? And if so, have they got any protocols in place?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I'll tackle the easy one first. So Cedric the Entertainer is going to be hosting Sunday's broadcast. And when it comes to COVID-19, the organizers have made the announcement that it's going to be taking place outdoors instead of inside of a theater. And this, of course, is because of the pandemic. So the initial plan was when it was going to be inside, they were going to allow every nominee to be there with one guest. Now with this new mandate, it's going to be outdoors in a much smaller space, just behind the theater in a tent scenario, and they're only inviting certain nominees. So I'm assuming that those certain nominees will be in some of the bigger categories. They haven't released who's on the guest list yet, but it's going to be very much stripped down. And I think it'll be interesting to watch it and see how they pull off this outdoor scenario, especially if the weather, gets a little bit iffy on Sunday night.
Absolutely. Let's talk some of the key categories that are going to be featured and some possible winners. When we're talking outstanding comedy series, I got to tell you, I have checked out a whole bunch of season one of Ted Lasso, and it's certainly one that I've heard a lot of people talking about. Is there anything out there that really could topple Ted Lasso?
I don't think so. I'm all up to date on Ted Lasso. Love the show. Everybody's been talking about it and how wonderful it is and the perfect television show for the pandemic. And I agree with everything that everybody's been saying. I think that there really isn't a chance for anything else to win in this category. That said, I do want to give kudos to a few of the shows. ABC's Blackish is nominated. Anthony Anderson's show, sitcom, which just finished its run, is fantastic. Emily in Paris, which got a lot of headlines for the wrong reasons in Netflix because critics said it was vapid and shouldn't even be nominated. And then there's The Flight Attendant starring Kaley Cuoco from The Big Bang Theory. That's probably the one that has the strongest or the best chance at dethroning Ted Lasso on Sunday night.
All right, let's talk drama series then. We've got The Crown going up against The Handmaid's Tale and This Is Us. Now, is this one where one of the top three is pretty much set to win, or could something like, The Mandalorian maybe sneak in and take the win?
I would love it if The Mandalorian won, Mike, but it's not going to. It's more of a sci-fi series and doesn't really fit in this drama category just because there are funny moments as well. I think that The Crown is probably going to take this category. It's been the perennial winner. It'll probably do very well in the acting categories as well. The Handmaid's Tale may give it a run for its money as well. And you can't count out This Is Us, which is the lone one here from conventional television, which may also have a chance, but I'm thinking it's probably going to go to The Crown.
Okay. It used to be you'd hear about a category of miniseries. Now we call them outstanding limited or anthology series.
Yeah.
The Queen's Gambit grabbed a lot of headlines in the last year. It's nominated in this category, but a lot being said about I May Destroy You, and I was a big fan of Mayor of Easttown. So what do you think that'll play out as?
Yeah, I was a huge fan of Mare of Easttown as well. Like, I tuned in not really having any expectations, and I was just blown away by their performances. Yeah, the Queen's Gambit, I think, has the best chance, but I would love it if Mare of Easttown took it, just because I think that HBO series deserves a lot more headlines. The other one that might sneak in is WandaVision, which is a part of the Marvel Universe, and it's on Disney Plus, and a lot of critics have really loved that, and it may turn out that the Academy does as well.
Let's just talk, you know, aside from the categories now, just trends that you're seeing in the nominations for the awards this year. It certainly does seem like we've moved really full swing now towards streaming services really being recognized. Things like Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus, Amazon, they seem to really be taking over. And what's interesting is this is happening, you know, this award show is happening a week before all the big network shows start coming back next week. So it's kind of interesting to juxtapose the nominations of these shows and these streaming services against the fall programming that is returning next week.
Yeah, it is kind of ironic that the primetime Emmys are airing on a conventional network when really there are only a handful of conventional television shows nominated in any of these categories. Yeah, we've been seeing this sea change for the last couple of years, and they're in full effect because, you know, Amazon, the Netflixes, the Disney Pluses, the HBOs, they're just taking over all of these categories. You know, you look at outstanding comedy series, Blackish is the only conventional network television show nominated in this category. And the same thing over on the drama side with This Is Us. So yeah, streamers are here. But the interesting thing for me, Mike, and maybe I'll ask this question of you, is, you know, is it worth, you know, is there a fear of missing out? You know, you need to pay for Netflix and to pay for Disney and to pay for Amazon. And these things add up very quickly. So, you know, if you don't have those platforms, do you feel like you're left out when you see all these shows nominated in these categories and you don't have access to them?
100%. You know, I've often asked the question, how much is too much? You know, how many streaming services are we willing to pay for? And with Ted Lasso, I watched because somebody else was visiting and said, hey, you know, you've got the Apple TV on your Roku. Let me log in and show you this show. And that's how I got to experience it. So I think we're going to see maybe a shift back a little bit towards the middle. And I think network programming will sort of rebound. I think that initial sort of splash of all the streaming services will, I think, start to slow a little bit, and we'll see a little bit of a return to that quote-unquote normalcy. And, you know, HBO, not a streaming service, right? I mean, this is one of those conventional networks, and right. I've watched one episode of American Rust so far. Really enjoyed that with Jeff Daniels. Is that something that makes an impact in next year's awards? It'll be very interesting to see. Greg, great talking to you, as always. Enjoy the Primetime Emmy Awards, and look forward to having you back here with Dave in a couple of weeks.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you very much. Greg David is our communications specialist here at AMI, speaking to us from Chelsea, Quebec. Well, that's going to do it for another week of Now with Dave Brown. It's been a lot of fun filling in for Dave. He will be back here on Monday in the host chair. I will be back in my usual spot, but also helping with a little bit of production as our producer, Andrika, enjoys a little vacation time. So, Andrika, enjoy, rest up, and we'll catch you in a week and change. Thanks to you for being here all week long. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and have a wonderful weekend. Dave Brown, News Director Mike Ross, Weather Reporter Nisreen Abdel-Majid, Sports Reporter Jeff Ryman, Audio Technical Producer and Entertainment Reporter Daniel Panamondo, TV Technical Producer Bruce McLarion, Live Production Switcher Sebastian McKenzie.
Senior show producer, Andrika Delanarol. Producers, Paul Daniel and Marianne Dion Jones. Audio technical supervisor, Paula Dineen. Manager of AMI Audio, Andy Frank. Director of TV production, Kara Nye. Vice President, Programming and Production, John Melville. President and CEO, David Arrington. Give us your feedback. 1-866-509-4545. Copyright 2021, Accessible Media, Inc.
An AMI original production.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.